Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Today we're going to talk estuaries. I'm delighted to be in conversation with two very wonderful people, Tom Lake, New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, estuary naturalist with the Hudson River Estuary Program, and Fran Dunwell, who is Special Assistant and Hudson River Estuary Coordinator at the DEC. So let me begin by asking you guys, first of all, welcoming you.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, Alan.
Glad you're here. Okay, first of all, let me start by asking, what is an estuary? Who wants to go first, Tom?
Well, an estuary is an inland body of water that's connected to the ocean, and the best definition would include the fact that it has tides,
right?
And it usually includes the reach of those tides upstream into tributaries until it reaches what we call the fall line, where on the highest of tides, the water cannot reach above a certain point. The other component of most estuaries is that it is a mixture of fresh water and salt water.
Right.
And where those two waters meet, it's called brackish. And this is this particular aspect of this body of water called an estuary is what gives it its ability to promote so much wildlife and produce so much wildlife and support so much wildlife.
Fran, you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, estuaries are really rich natural environments. This is where a lot of fish come to spawn. You'll have ocean fish like striped bass, Atlantic sturgeon, shad coming into estuaries to complete their life cycle. So without estuaries, we don't have oceans.
So without fooling around about this, the Hudson River is a pretty good example of an estuary, right?
It certainly is.
Right. And my question would be, at what point does the salt water reach to before it falls backwards with the tide?
That's a moving target. There are many forces at work in an estuary. Currents, which is the horizontal movement of water, tides, which is the vertical movement of water, barometric pressure, wind, the amount of water that's being put into the Hudson River from meltwater. In the winter when we get a great freeze, there's not much, so salt water is able to intrude up the Hudson River. So as tides move up and down the river and all these forces are at work, the point at which where fresh water meets salt water is a constant moving target every minute of the day. Those of us who work on the river have a saying that no one moment on this river, this estuary, will ever be repeated again. Those pieces that all come together will never come together in quite that same way again. Well, so the answer to your question is it is a moving target.
Fran?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about saltwater in the Hudson is that it really changes according to the weather. So when you have a lot of rain in the watershed, so in the Adirondacks, in the Mohawk Valley, or even in the upper Hudson Estuary, when you have a lot of rain, it pushes the salt downstream. When you have a drought, the salt comes upstream. I grew up in Poughkeepsie. We get our drinking water in Poughkeepsie from the Hudson. And from time to time, the salt front is actually approaching the drinking water intake in Poughkeepsie.
So my question remains, in all recorded history that you guys are aware of, what's the furthest that salt water ever got up the Hudson River?
I think there's records of it being at Hyde Park, which is about 82 miles north of the Battery.
That's pretty close to Poughkeepsie.
Well, it's above Poughkeepsie. We measure the Hudson River in river miles north of the Battery for research purposes and for navigational purposes. For example, Albany here, we're at river mile 145. Poughkeepsie would be like 76, and Hyde Park would be 82. So to answer your question, it's about Hyde Park. The other aspect of an estuary that is very important is the difference between saltwater and freshwater. Saltwater is denser than freshwater. And so oftentimes, as Fran mentioned, we get a rain event and a lot of fresh water is being pushed down the river. It will ride over top of this saltier water from the sea. And so you'll get this layered effect in the Hudson River. When that gets pushed around by currents and wind and everything else, it creates this tremendous soup almost, this tremendously important mix of salt and fresh water that promotes growth of, as Fran mentioned, fish and other aquatic animals.
So Fran, I'm fascinated by what you told me before. What if, in fact, you were home in Poughkeepsie in the old days and the salt had arrived? Would you have actually gotten, when you turned on the tap, would you have gotten a mouthful of salt water?
No, because it would be extremely dilute. But it becomes a problem for communities that do get their drinking water from the Hudson. And one of the fascinating things about our river is that there are ways that the saltwater position can be managed. So there's a reservoir in the upper Hudson, the Sacandaga Reservoir. When the water level, the salt, is approaching Poughkeepsie, they will release water from the Sacandaga Reservoir.
Really?
To push the saltwater down.
Wow.
The Hudson is a very highly engineered system.
Now, we know that our friend and mentor, Pete Siegel, lived where you live in Beacon.
My neighbor.
Right, and we loved him, and he was a big hero here. Anyway, he at one point said, and we're doing so well, we're swimming in the Hudson again. Are we?
Absolutely.
We are.
Yes. There are only a few beaches on the Hudson where you can swim from a beach, but people are jumping off of rocks, they're jumping off of bridges, jumping off
of
boats.
Well, some of them who jump off bridges aren't, you know, that healthy. Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about the healthy people who are doing it for the thrill of being the Hudson. You know, we have really made incredible progress in cleaning up the river so that it is safe for swimming. There are places where you wouldn't want to swim. You don't want to swim near the outfall of a sewage treatment plant. There are also risks. People might be caught up in tides. They could be caught up in unsafe currents. So it's not something I always, when people ask me about swimming, I'm always giving these cautionary notes. You don't want to do, you know, you need
consult
to be
your
educated.
Doctor before you do this.
Yeah, you need to be educated. But we've made incredible progress in cleaning up the river, but there's still a ways to go. There are times when the river is polluted with bacteria.
Well, but there's this big discussion that goes on between the environmental community, for example, and GE. Mm. Now, GE, we know, was responsible for a lot of this pollution that's in the river. And they're saying, no, we don't have to do any more. We already did what we said we were going to do and the rest of it. So are PCBs still in the river we're swimming in?
Yes, in very minute amounts. And it doesn't affect people who are swimming in it. The problem with PCBs is when you consume it. And even PCBs in drinking water is not really at a level that's going to pose a public health threat. It's really when you consume fish that have PCBs in them, that it becomes magnified in your body.
So my friend Joan Davidson used to have a shad party every year. We don't have shad anymore. We don't eat shad anymore.
We have
sure.
shad. We're just not allowed to take them. And not because of pollution, but because of population levels
right.
had fallen.
Right, quite right. So we have these various fish, but I see people from time to time still fishing, and I'm assuming they're still eating that stuff. Is that a bad idea?
Well, it's not recommended to eat many fish from the Hudson. So the health department has recommended levels that they basically say women and children shouldn't eat any if you're a woman of childbearing age because it can affect your endocrine system. It can affect the development of a fetus. So they say don't eat any. And for certain other fish, I would recommend that people go to the health department website and look up the health advisory. It recommends exactly, you know, how much fish they say you could eat and from what sections of the river.
This is fascinating. I'm fascinated by the idea of what comes from the Atlantic, you know, into the bay, into the river, whether or not the pollutants in the ocean and the bay are coming upstream also, as well as the PCBs coming down. Tom, did you want to speak
Well, most of our health advisories in New York State, people believe it's just for the Hudson River, but a lot of the advisories we have on contaminants are for all waters in New York State, and so it's not just the Hudson River. The other thing that people often get the wrong idea about the Hudson River and your ability to use the Hudson River and even swim in Hudson River is that a lot of beaches have signs saying no swimming, and that is taken as an indication of the water not being healthy for you. In almost all cases, those are because there are no lifeguards, and it's an insurance issue, and so they're saying they don't say no swimming because we don't have any insurance. They'll say just no swimming, so people get that idea. Back to just for a moment on the salinity in the Hudson River, you were talking about whether you can taste the salt in the water. Well, salinity, the amount of salt in the water at this latitude, say off Coney Island, is about 32 to 35 parts per thousand. For every 1,000 parts of water, 32 to 35 would be salt. We, most of us, can detect on our tongue about 3 parts per thousand. And most times in the summer, around Newburgh and Beacon up as far, maybe as far as Poughkeepsie, you can taste that little bit on your tongue, 3 parts per thousand. So that is the mix.
But is that bad?
No, it's not. As a naturalist, for example, you tell me the season and let me taste the water, and I can almost tell you what fish are out there because they will follow the condition, which, as I've just described, by season, by the amount of salinity, by the water temperature. But getting to your other question on the fish that come in from the sea, there hasn't been no real conclusions on whether or not the fish that tend to carry less of a load of toxins are those that come in from the sea. It may have more to do with their physiological makeup, their fat content, for example.
Uh-huh. Well, I do want to stay with this business about the hip bone being somehow attached to the ankle bone sooner or later. Everything is sort of connected, right? So I'm a Fire Islander. I was raised on Fire Island in the summers, and the Great South Bay, you could get anything you wanted. We used to sit there and just grab crabs and blowfish. Can't find a blowfish anymore, or I can anyway. Not that I try. But the pollution level in the Great South Bay is much greater than it once was. I don't know if it's getting any better now. But, you know, everything is connected to everything else. And that has to be a big part of what you guys do, right, Fran?
Absolutely. So that's the fundamental principle of ecosystems, is that everything is connected.
This is one of those things that we've learned in the last, well, since I've been working as a naturalist, is the connectivity. I've had fish that I've tagged in the Hudson River sturgeon that have ended up in North Carolina. I've had striped bass I've tagged that end up in Maine. In the last week.
Is that right?
Yeah. And now those are fish and they're swimming. But in the last week, I was able to find two bald eagles that are wintering here that, because of the bands on their ankle, they're from the state of Maine. So whether you look in the air or you look in the water, you're finding this tremendous connectivity between the Hudson River estuary and the entire Atlantic coast.
So what is so special about the Hudson River? What makes the Hudson River, you know, different than other estuaries?
As a naturalist.
What is a naturalist, by the way?
A naturalist is an educator. Most naturalists see themselves as someone who never grew up. We've maintained our sense of imagination, our sense of wonder and awe, and using those skills, we're able to communicate our view of the world, the natural world, to our students. And I think that's the best way to look at a naturalist.
Do you have students?
I have students from first grade to graduate students. I was teaching formerly at Dutchess Community College. Now I teach for the Hudson River Estuary Program, and I take first graders to the Hudson River. I take graduate students to the Hudson River and all ages in between. And it's the outdoor classroom that makes the Hudson River, from the Adirondacks to the sea, nearly 320 miles, the most outstanding classroom that you can imagine. When I was in grade school and high school, we learned about estuaries like the Mississippi River and the Nile River from books in our classroom.
So what's the difference between the Hudson and the Mississippi?
Well, those you're not going to take your students and stand by the shore and show it to them and explain it to them. But the Hudson River, we can take the students there.
Why not? Why can't you take them to see the Mississippi?
Well, let's reframe it a different way. So, I mean, the Mississippi is, you know, a very long river, flows through the heartland of America.
Indeed.
The Hudson is, by contrast, a very short river with a huge, long history and outsized importance in the ecosystem. So the Hudson is only 315 miles long, and half of that, it's an estuary. The other half, it is flowing one way. When it reaches the Troy Dam, it begins its tidal feature flowing both ways with the currents. So it's relatively small compared to the Mississippi. But it is one of the richest estuaries in the United States because it has its historic species. It is the spawning ground for major species in the entire Atlantic coast. It's a healthier estuary.
Like, Fran, I'm sorry.
So it's the spawning ground for, as I said earlier, striped bass, Atlantic sturgeon,
and
American shad.
I'm sorry for being ignorant, but spawning ground means where they're born?
Yes, right. So fish is actually very miraculous, and Tom might be able to explain this in more colorful terms, but basically you have ocean fish that are traveling up and down the Atlantic coast for their adult life.
Stripers?
Striped bass, Atlantic sturgeon, American shad, and nature calls at some point. They say it's time to reproduce, it's time to spawn. And they come into estuaries, and they go through salt water, they go through brackish water, their metabolism changes, their whole physiology changes from being adapted to a saltwater environment to then being adapted to a freshwater environment where they lay their eggs, they reproduce, and then their young grow up in the Hudson for their early months of life, and then they kind of bounce along with the currents and the tides, and they end up eventually in New York Harbor, where they leave to go to the sea.
Okay, so I wanted to follow this up, because I remember those guys standing out on the beach on Fire Island, surf casting for stripers.
Yes.
Right. Does every striper that's out there end up coming around to the Hudson?
They are all born in an estuary. They could be born in Chesapeake Bay. They could be born in the Hudson. But they are all born in estuaries.
Tom?
These fish that come in the river, herring, shad, striped bass, and others, Atlantic tomcod, in fact, they're in the river right now. They're the only fish that spawns in the winter. Their offspring imprint on where they're born, whether it's in the Hudson River or whether it's a tributary. And we believe this to be true. And when they leave and they become an adult, when they come back to spawn, we believe they come back to where they were born. There is this homing instinct. And these fish, particularly the striped bass, have a very irregular life history. Some stay in the river for a year or two, some leave. And it's some of the magic of the river is that the Hudson River estuary and the fisheries in particular is an area where there's so many things that we do not know. And that's what makes it so wonderful to be able to teach students.
Oh, I want to remind everybody who we're talking to. We're talking to Tom Lake and we're talking to Fran Dunwell. These are people who know the estuary and protect it and work with it all the time. And Tom's a consultant for DEC, and Fran is the boss, special assistant and Hudson River Estuary Coordinator. So folks, I guess I want to know, let's say I was in the first grade, and I raised my hand, and I asked this question. Mr. Lake, how do fish get pregnant?
It depends on the fish. There's a variety of ways.
Well, let's talk stripers.
Well, striped bass, the female lays her eggs, and the male swims over and broadcasts the sperm, and they...
What do you say, broadcast the sperm?
Spray them in the water.
Okay. Yeah. And the sperm then go to the eggs?
Yes. And same thing with shad and herring. And then we have a fish like our seahorses and our pipefish, where the female gets pregnant. And then at some point, she will take her eggs and swim over to the male, who has a brood pouch, like a kangaroo. And he will open that brood pouch, and she'll put the eggs in the brood pouch. And she'll say, so long, and she'll leave. And the male then will carry those to term. And the male actually goes through labor, a male seahorse and a male pipefish. I've seen this snorkeling. I've seen pipefish anyway. They actually go through labor. The male seahorses get this anguished look on their face, and finally the brood pouch opens up, and out swim all these little small seahorses. It's just amazing. So the question of how they get pregnant.
No, and, seahorse in the
and in a pipefish.
But in the salt water or in the...
Well, with pipefish, it can be brackish water, and they're also in salt water. Seahorses really like some salt. We have 221 different species of fish that we know about in the Hudson River. They've all got a story to tell. They've all got their preferred habitats. They've all got their limits. Some of them can live here in Albany in the ocean, as long as you allow them to have the time to make the physiological change of going from freshwater to saltwater. There's others that live here in Albany, freshwater fish. Throw them in the Atlantic Ocean and they're going to die. And there are saltwater fish, throw them here in Albany and they're going to die. So there's this wonderful mix of life histories of different kinds of fish that go about doing their thing in vastly different ways, including getting pregnant.
Fran, I used to pick up seahorses on the beach. They were dried out. I never saw a live one. Have you? You've seen a
lot of seahorses? Yes, I have. In fact, one of the fun things we do is we support an organization called the River Project, which is based at Hudson River Park in New York City. And every year they will put traps over the side of the pier and they'll catch anything from toadfish to seahorses to striped bass or eels, and they'll put them in aquariums for people to see.
Does the Hudson River Estuary have an aquarium?
Well, I think that would be the closest thing we have to an aquarium is the River Project. There is a project underway right now to build what's called an estuarium within Hudson River Park. And the idea is that we'll have live animal exhibits with fish that are found under the piers at Hudson River Park. But that is a year or two away from seeing the light of day.
Wow.
You know what serves as kind of an aquarium is every time that myself and my colleagues who work for Fran, one of the favorite things I do is go to the Hudson River with students, and I stand on the shore and I say, look up the river, and they look up the river. I say, look down the river, look down the river. And I say, let's say that's a 3-mile reach. And I'll say, in that 3-mile reach, there are a million fish. And the students will roll their eyes or smirk. And I'll say, oh, okay. So I take our net out. We haul our net through the water. Passive use device. It doesn't hurt the fish. We pull it in. And in 100 feet of beach, we catch 100 fish. Mm. And you can almost hear the students click, click, click in their head. They're doing the math. Let's see, 3 miles. We just did 100 feet. We caught 100 fish. He might be right. There might be a million fish out there. And it's that. It's not an aquarium. It's not an aquarium, but it's real life experience on the Hudson River. Of course, when we do this, we bring fish tanks with us, and we put the fish in the tank so they can see them, and then we put them back in the river again. But it's almost like a live aquarium on the banks of the Hudson River.
So, Tom and Fran, what is the Hudson River Almanac?
Well, the genesis of the Almanac began 23 years ago. There were a lot of us who worked on the Hudson River, teachers, scientists, students, a whole array of different people. And we would get together from time to time and tell stories. And most of them were true. And some of them were so fascinating that we often said to ourselves, if only we had a forum to share these with other people. We would tell stories of things going on in the high peaks of the Adirondacks or New York Harbor, and people at the opposite end of the river had no idea this was going on. So we said, gee, well, it would really be nice. So Freya came up with the idea of, why don't we formalize this forum and get the public involved? And so 23 years ago, we began soliciting from people their stories, their adventures, their feelings, their poetry, in whatever venue they saw the, in whatever way they saw the Hudson River, express it to us. And so it began very, very, very slowly. It took a while for people to get involved. But now after 23 years, we have a distribution list of somewhere around 23,000.
Is it on paper or is it?
Well, it began the first 6 or 7 years, it was actually a published book. It was being sold in stores. Now it's an online. And with the online one, which people can get for free, it's a weekly natural history journal that goes out with the stories. These stories are sent to us by everyday people, And we put them in there with photographs. And so people in other ends of the river, I get emails from people. I got one the other day from someone in Manhattan who doesn't get out very much or can't get out very much. And he said, it's so wonderful that I can vicariously live the wildlife of the Hudson Valley through the Almanac. And if you get a couple of those, you realize that you're making a difference in people's lives.
Yeah. So, Fran, you're to be congratulated for coming up with this idea. So do you see an evolution in the Almanac itself?
Well, the biggest evolution was going from print to electronic. So now it's a weekly newsletter. And if people want to subscribe or if they want to submit an observation of nature in the Hudson Valley, they can.
But it's free, right?
It's free.
Yeah.
And you can use any search engine. Just type in Hudson River Almanac.
Right.
And it will take you to our website and it will give you a pop-up where you can subscribe.
Is there any music?
No music, but we
wonderful photos.
We are.
Is Pete's song "Golden River" on it?
Yeah. Pete has been in the Almanac many times. Not now, obviously, but some of the finest entries we ever got was from Pete. In fact,
I'll bet that's true. He really loved that river.
Yeah. So it's not 3D or 4D yet, but we have started putting photographs in there, and we're getting more and more people who are out there doing backyard photography and sending us images, you know, fantastic images of a bald eagle carrying, for example, a herring in its talons to feed its young at a nest. The bald eagles are nesting on the Hudson, which when I started my career, that was unheard of.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I had it in the back of my head I was going to go there because I was with Pete once in his house. And there was a whole hell of a lot of eagles flying around.
Yeah, well, his beacon is a prime area for wintering eagles. Yeah.
But has that always been the case, or is this a reformation now?
From 1897 to 1997, there were no baby eagles produced in the Hudson Valley for various reasons. Poisoning, bounties, DDT, example. In fact, in 1897, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times. I have this op-ed piece that said that we have a problem with eagles. There's too many of them around. People's pets are disappearing off their back doors. Something's got to be done with these eagles. And, you know, it was amazing because for 100 years after that, we had no baby eagles. 1997, we had the first one in Greene County. Yeah, at one time. There were bounties, yeah. It's like today, there are laws, but not everybody follows the laws. But DDT was the big hitter. DDT rendered female eagles incapable of laying an egg with a thick enough eggshell so when they sat on it, it would not crack.
Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, we were mentioning about the Hudson River Almanac. A good example is a couple of days ago, I was down in Orange County in the Black Dirt Agricultural Region, and we sent out the word, and a lot of people came. There were at least 5,000 snow geese from the Arctic breeders that were here for the winter.
How can you tell that they're from the Arctic as opposed to...
Well, that's where their range is. Scientists have...
You can just see them, in other words. You can identify them by seeing them.
Yeah, we know what a snow goose looks like.
And what does a snow goose look like?
They look like a smaller version of a Canada goose. They're white with some black wing tips. They're absolutely gorgeous. We looked out in this field. It was a sea of white, and it was the most impressive thing. You don't see these things all the time. It would have been a moment or a day or two that would have passed. But with the Almanac, we were able to capture photographs and all. And the interesting about that field, in 2004, the very next field over, I had conducted some archaeology. And the evidence that I got from excavating that field convinced me that people were living on that field for at least the last 7,000 years. Oh. And so as a naturalist, I stand there and I'm looking at this incredible, spectacular sea of white with these geese from the Arctic, another great connection. And I'm wondering, 7,000 years ago, the people like us who were living there, what did they think of this spectacular? Did they feel the same way? Did they feel closeness to it? You know, did they feel the same as we do today when they see something so awe-inspiring as that?
Fran, do you get enough money from the state to do your work?
We do. Yeah, in fact, we
make a budget request every year, and then you see what you
get. We've been very fortunate that for the last several years, our budget has gone up. We've had a budget bump every year. In the last few years, the governor has proposed another budget bump for us this year. We'll wait to see what the legislature does, but we have seen increases in recent years.
Well, if the legislature had gotten a raise, you might get your bump. My question is, how many other people besides you and Tom are working on this estuary project?
Well, I should mention that I edit the Hudson River Almanac, and my colleague, who does every bit as much as I do, is Steve Stan. Mm-hmm. Between myself and Steve, and other people working for Fran as well, but Steve and I are really the ones that do this. So Steve is an integral part of this, and then there are others as well.
So I'll get you into trouble. I'll ask you guys a question. There is now a very controversial thing going on the Hudson. They want to park, you know, barges and ships at various places, Fran. So the question to you would be, how will that affect the Hudson River estuary?
Well, first of all, that's a Coast Guard decision, but there are two authorized anchorages now, one at Hyde Park and one down by Yonkers. The one at Hyde Park happens to be right over the spawning ground for Atlantic sturgeon.
Wow.
So ecologically, it's...
disaster.
It's not a good thing from our standpoint. How this all plays out remains to be seen. We have communicated to the Coast Guard our concerns about the protection of the spawning ground. You know, you have ships that are anchoring there. They have very large anchors, and there will be some anchor drift. So we do underwater maps of the Hudson using the latest technology. So we can actually see anchor scars in that area. And the sturgeon are spawning there because it has exactly the right underwater conditions that they need. The right geology, the right depth of water, the right salinity. So it's a very particular environment that they need, and we have expressed our concerns about that to the Coast Guard.
So why don't you just sue them? Why don't you get the Attorney General, if he's talking to the governor on that particular day, why don't you get the Attorney General to sue, you know, the Coast Guard?
Well, we're working it out. Our first approach is logic and correspondence. So we've corresponded with the Coast Guard. We've identified our concerns.
Well, but of course they're asking for... several other moorings now.
Yes.
And each of those will probably have some kind of ecological ramification, don't you think?
Yes, there are definitely ramifications, and we've communicated with them about it, and I imagine that conversation will go on for quite some time.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is shifting gears just a little bit, because we were talking about the Almanac, and I think it's a good time to mention something else about that. Earlier, we were talking about the connectivity of the Hudson River estuary with the Atlantic coast. Another area that is a terrific way to show this connection is through marine mammals. You'd be surprised how few people that live in the Hudson Valley realize that we have hooded seals, harp seals, harbor porpoises, bottlenose dolphins. We had a manatee. Last month, we had a humpback whale in the Hudson River. You tell people, they think you're putting them on, but it is true. And the presence of a lot of marine mammals in the Hudson is a direct result of the tremendous productivity of fish in the Hudson River.
You mean the more fish, the more there is.
Exactly. Most of them are in here.
They're following their
prey. The humpback whale was incredible. It was in the New York Harbor, and it would open its huge jaws, and it would just scoop out of the water several hundred herring at a time, a fish called the Atlantic menhaden.
So why was the whale there?
It was hungry. And
But we don't get a lot of whales.
No, we
don't.
And the speculation on this is that it was in the lower bay outside the Verrazano Narrows. And as the tide and current were coming into the upper bay, 5 million menhaden were coming in. And the whale said, fine, I'll follow them right in. And the harbor itself, except for the boat traffic, is not a terribly inhospitable place. It's a little shallow for a humpback whale, but it's not that bad. And the hunger is a real driving force. Many of the other marine mammals do the same thing. This time of the year, it's not uncommon to find harbor seals as far upriver as Albany, sitting on ice floes with their bellies full of fish. If you have to go looking for them. I would invite people to get themselves a good pair of 1050 binoculars, and especially in the winter, spend time around the Hudson River, because you will see bald eagles, wintering bald eagles from points north, and you may see harbor seals or other seals. A year ago, December, you may have heard about this, we rescued a gray seal from Saratoga County. And you might say, what is a gray seal doing in Saratoga County? This was a gray seal that was born up in the Arctic. It made its way into New York Harbor. We think it fell into bad company. We think it fell in with some harbor seals. Made its way up the Hudson River, probably got through the federal dam at Troy. Again, following fish, found itself in the upper Hudson, went up to lock one of the Hudson-Champlain Canal, following fish, got up above there, and suddenly realized it could not find its way back down again. This is a marine mammal of the Arctic. And so finally, a year ago in December, the Riverhead Foundation from Long Island went up, and they did a rescue. and we rescued this gray seal.
What'd you do?
Well, it was stuck inside the lock, and they were lowering the level of the lock for winter maintenance. And lo and behold, this gray seal that we knew was around, we couldn't figure out where it went to, there it was in the lock. Very serendipitous. It was a stroke of luck. They were able to get it and take it down and rehab it on Long Island, at Riverhead Long Island, and release it with a radio transmitter for the satellites. And for the next 2 months, we followed the trail of that gray seal up through Narragansett Bay, past Newport, Rhode Island, through the Cape Cod Canal. It spent a month in Cape Cod Bay. It then came around Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and it ended up heading offshore to a little island called Little Gull Island, where gray seals go to congregate in the wintertime. This entire story is made wonderful by the fact that it connects these faraway places to Saratoga County. And that way, it's sort of a magical way of looking at the river and the animals that live here.
So you had both herring and whale in the river?
Well, we had herring. You know, all these animals that I'm talking about is...
This is the beginning of a very bad joke, I want you to know.
Do you want to continue with it before
go ahead. But the punchline is, the herring looks up at the captain who has asked him where his friend the whale is and said, am I my blubber's kipper?
Oh,
but,
okay.
But anyway...
You know, one of the things that I tell my students when we get thinking about how important we are is that all these animals and most of the plants were here before we were here. There's great time depth in the Hudson Valley. When the first Dutch arrived here in the 17th century, they met people in the Hudson Valley who could trace their ancestry back 400 generations. Since the Dutch came, we've had 17 generations. And it kind of puts things in perspective.
Sure.
When we start talking about, you know, relegating the past to the past and not remembering what was going on here a long time ago.
So speaking of which, what can you tell me about the Algonquins?
Well, that's a language group. The Algonquian people are the ones that lived in the Hudson Valley. You are sitting right now in the homeland of the Mohican people.
Yeah.
To the south of here, there were other tribes. They spoke the same language, or the same language group, Algonquian. To the west of here, out into the Mohawk River Valley, were the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois people, and they spoke Iroquoian. They didn't always get along very well, but the tension between those two groups of people heightened once Europeans showed up. Europeans saw a wonderful opportunity to pit them against each other, and then they would step in and take the spoils when it was all over. The people that lived here, though, the Mohican people here, they were the ones that met Henry Hudson when he came up the Hudson River. And the life of Henry Hudson and his crew were totally in the hands of the Mohican people. And the Mohican people, according to records, notes that were taken, could not have been nicer. They treated him so wonderful and so well.
Probably a big mistake.
Depends on how you look.
Well,
I think it was
them.
The right thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, one thing, you know, it's interesting that 9/11, September 2001, 9/11, there was a previous 9/11. 9/11, 2016-09, on September 11th, was when Henry Hudson sailed up to Manhattan. And I've often felt that that was twice that the people of Manhattan lost their sense of innocence.
Mm.
The first time was when the Dutch showed up on September 11th, and then on 2001, the people of Manhattan once again lost their sense of innocence.
So, Fran Dunwell, I guess the question that I would have of you as the boss is, are you in touch with those Indian tribes who are up along the estuary at all?
There are people who are working with them. I personally have not been any time recently. I know Tom does, so let's have Tom speak to that.
One of the things that you learn very quickly when you teach, like when I do a program or I go into a classroom and I talk about the native people, the Hudson Valley, the Algonquian, I have to be careful because by the end of that talk, the students will all be crying. What happened in the Hudson Valley is that very quickly the Dutch and then the English and then the Americas decided that the valley wasn't big enough for indigenous peoples and what we wanted to see here in the Hudson Valley. The land was too valuable. So today, if you want to find the heartland of the Mohican people, you go to Wisconsin. A little further down the river, the Lenape people who are in Westchester County, go to Oklahoma. So, you know, there are Mohicans around. I know some Mohican people, but there's a couple here, a couple there, but there's no great numbers of them. They have been moved out. The reverse of that, my son teaches in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He teaches in a high school. In that area in New Mexico, all of his students, 80% of them are Native Americans and 20% are Mexican or of Mexican descent. Entirely different way of looking at Native people than we do here in the Northeast. So to answer your question, there are Native people who have contributed to the Almanac, but they've done it as a citizen. They didn't say, well, I'm an Indian, I'm a Native American, therefore I'm going to submit to the city Almanac. It's always as a private citizen.
Now, Fran, there are a lot of interested groups up and down the Hudson to preserve the Hudson, you know, You could probably list them all for me, but they're basically trying to lobby the government and to make sure that everything is copus mentis on the Hudson. Do you work with those groups?
Oh, yes. I mean,
Riverkeeper or, yeah.
Yeah, we have an advisory committee for our program. Our program was established by state legislation, actually, exactly 30 years ago, 1987. Mario Cuomo signed the bill that created our program. And it set up the position of estuary coordinator, which I have, and I've been in that position the whole time. And
how did you get there?
How did I get there?
Yeah, I mean, when you came in for your interview, what were they impressed by?
My life has been really a charmed life, I have to say. I was approached about taking that job without an interview.
But there must have been a reason why they approached you.
Well, I had worked for the Center for the Hudson River Valley, was my first environmental job. That later merged with Scenic Hudson. Through that work, I got to know a lot of the people who were very active in the Hudson Valley. And so I was a known quantity. DEC was looking for someone to lead a Hudson River program. And because I was known, they reached out to me and said, you know, would you be interested?
So what education qualified you for this?
Well, I was in graduate school at the time that I got the job offer. And so I said, look, I won't be available till May. Can you wait till May? And so I think in part it was the fact that I had gone to Yale University and had the background in environmental studies that that program offered. Also, I was writing a book about the Hudson. I have subsequently published two books about the Hudson.
What are their names?
One is called the Hudson River Highlands, and the other is called the Hudson America's River.
Okay.
And both books, I don't receive any income. I've donated the royalties for those to the Natural Heritage Trust, which is part of New York State Parks. So I've done it really out of caring for people to understand the Hudson and know its history, because the history really informs our present. So I was an author. I had been an activist working outside of government trying to have the Hudson be conserved. And then I was in graduate school. So that combination of factors and just being known, I think, in the community was something that led to the job that I have now.
So do you have to get out? I mean, in other words, is this an office job or is this a job where you really have to be on the river at some point?
Well, it has become over the years more and more of an office job. And I really rely on people like Tom who are out on the water all the time. Someday I'll retire and my fantasy retirement is that I'll tag along with Tom Lake every day and see all the things that he sees on a daily basis. But we run an organization that does everything from managing fisheries to major education programs. We do a lot of work in the watershed to inform and empower citizens to be effective stewards of the Hudson. We work on water quality. So we're really touching every aspect of the ecosystem. And so a lot of what I do is managing, pulling all those pieces together.
Tom Lake?
Well, I was thinking, Fran used the word a moment ago, we haven't touched on this idea of watershed. The Hudson River Almanac covers the Hudson River watershed. It's almost 13,400 square miles. A little bit of Vermont, a little bit of Massachusetts, a little bit of Connecticut, a little bit of New Jersey, and, well, New York. And for people who would want to send something, contribute to the Almanac, it's within the watershed. And what we look for are our
the definition
stories
of the watershed in this case is?
Well, a watershed is a geologic term. It's the theory that a drop of water that drops within a watershed, in our case, will end up through the Hudson River into the Atlantic Ocean or into the Atlantic Ocean. To the west of here, we have the Delaware River watershed. That water will end up in Delaware Bay. It has to do with elevation. Beyond that, the Susquehanna River and so on. So it's a geologic concept that was created by the last glacier we had, which was here, 20,000 years ago. 20,000 years ago, Alan, we'd be sitting here with 10,000 feet of ice over our heads, or we'd be sitting on top of the ice perhaps at that point. But what we're looking for with this almanac is we get a lot of material. We're looking for items, stories that define the season. A good example are those snow geese. Another good example is I was out in the Mohawk River yesterday, February 1st, no ice on the Mohawk. I mean, that is really unheard of. You can draw conclusions from why that is.
I was just about to go there with you.
Yeah, I mean, and we're looking for stories about wildlife, flora and fauna. And if it's an eagle, oftentimes I get one line, I saw an eagle today. But what was the eagle up to? What was it doing? How was it interacting with the environment? Those are the things that make a story. It gives it context.
So climate change, guys, your jobs, even though you'll deny it, are extraordinarily political if you think of it. In other words, if you call, if politics, as I have often lectured, is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources exist, you know, on the Hudson, and you have to protect those to some degree. You want the eagles there, you want the flora, the fauna to be there, and it's your job, I take it, to make sure that all is well with the Hudson. And aren't there groups who feel differently than you do?
Well, one of the things that's like interesting about the Hudson is that people are experiencing climate change in a fairly direct way, regardless of their politics.
No, I'm not talking Republican, Democratic now. I'm talking about some guy who wants to dump residue into the river. That's politics too, right?
Yeah, so I think your question was about climate change. Is that where we're heading?
We always can go anywhere we want.
Well, let's talk about climate change because it's extremely important. You know, the sea level is rising. It's rising measurably here. People have been taking measurements for 100 years at the Battery in New York City, and they've been taking measurements more and more frequently. In my lifetime, the Hudson River is up 6 inches from when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And it's projected that sea level will rise more quickly as the glaciers melt and as the ocean expands as it becomes warmer. We see the direct result of that here in the Hudson Valley, especially when there are storms. But even on an average day, I was on the train down to New York City about a week ago, the water level was extremely high because we had just the right combination of tides, cycles of the moon, barometric pressure out in the ocean. You can see high water. In fact, you know, you can subscribe to an email newsletter out of Stevens Institute in New Jersey that will give you predictions as to when you're going to have high water. And those high water predictions have been coming through my email quite regularly in the last week. During Superstorm Sandy, you had several feet of storms, and it went above the usual level of high tide in many cases in these coastal cities, right up to the steps of apartment buildings. It flooded restaurants. It flooded people's homes, you know, on the Rondout Creek in Kingston, which is tidal. It's not unusual at all to have this kind of storm
surge. When you say the Rondout is tidal, what do you mean? It goes up and down?
Yes, all the way up to the Eddyville Dam. That's why you have so many boats, so many harbors on the Rondout Creek in Kingston.
It's not far. It's just up to Eddyville Dam, which is a few miles.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's significant.
Sure.
So climate change is a reality.
Yes.
Al Gore got a Nobel Prize for it, and The Inconvenient Truth, I believe, was the name of the movie. And he stood in front of a map and showed you exactly what was going to happen. Along comes Superstorm Sandy, and it does.
That's right.
Yeah, one of the things that we're seeing is these storms, like Superstorm Sandy. You know, we used to call them 100-year storms. We've sort of dropped that designation. A lot of the scientists working on the river have said things like, the interval between big storms like that was great enough so that the river could recover. Now they're coming close enough together so the river does not have a chance to catch its breath.
What do you mean by catch its breath?
Well, looking at all, the thing I would say about the Hudson River, maybe the most important thing to remember about our entire conversation, is the Hudson River is extremely dynamic. There are a lot of things, there's a lot of background noise going on. It makes it difficult to measure things like climate change. If we're talking about Walden Pond, a very static environment, we could measure climate change fairly easily. The Hudson River's got so many things going on in the background, and there's this fine line between weather and climate. And it's one of those things that, as one who believes there is climate change, we have to be careful not to confuse one with the other. But for the Hudson River and these storms, the last big storm that we had, the amount of water coming down out of the Mohawk into the lower estuary was so great that it actually drowned a lot of submerged aquatic vegetation. It uprooted a lot of it. A lot of native plants, like wild celery, for example. Wild celery is the backbone of goose and duck migration in the fall time. If that's not there, ducks and geese are going to say, it's like driving on the thruway without any rest stops, you know? You can't do that. So those are the kinds of things. Now, you'd have a superstorm, you might lose your submerged aquatic vegetation, but it would come back in 3 or 4 years, and it'd be fine. Now these storms are coming at such a rate that, among other things, population of fish, spawning seasons, entire year classes of fish. If the storm comes at the wrong time, you could lose a year class of fish due to the tremendous turbidity of the water, the volume of the water, the velocity of the water. All these factors could come into play.
So, Tom, like, how serious is this?
It's ongoing. You can't predict. I mean, at least I cannot. Climatologists may be able to tell you, yeah, we're going to have one next year and one the year after.
But how serious is the destruction of, you know, the celery stuff and everything else? I mean, how serious is this for the way we live?
You make a good point. And if you think that the river, that we're not connected to the river, our well-being is directly connected to the Hudson River. And the well-being of the river as a functioning system, as a biological functioning system, means all of the components have to be healthy. And when you begin to lose certain areas due to these storms, you're upsetting the balance. One of the magic things about the Hudson River that makes it so productive for fish to come in from the sea is that they do have this area of fresh and salt and brackish water. And there are these places where they can go lay their eggs. There are beds of wild celery where the babies can hide so the big fish don't eat them. This all comes together in a beautiful, magical mosaic that supports this bounty of wildlife. Along comes Hurricane Sandy, and pieces of that puzzle are being thrown out.
Fran, what are your fights?
What are our fights?
Yeah, obviously everybody has a job. Everybody has to fight somebody. I may fight with National Public Radio from time to time. I mean, who do you have to fight with?
Well, this is going to be a little bit of an odd answer for that. I tend to be someone who's really focused on making good things happen.
Mm-hmm. Making good choices.
Good choices. We tell our grandson. And, you know, I tend to focus on what we can do that's really going to make this place better. And so a lot of the work that I do is helping people who live in the Hudson Valley understand how to be better stewards of the Hudson. We do a lot of education.
But every time you do something, you probably tick off somebody. I mean, you know, if somebody wants to clean up the upper Hudson of PCBs, they're going to tick off the people who put them there.
Yes.
So when I say, who do you have to fight with, in order to make things better, sometimes you got to change things around a little bit, right?
Well, we are certainly, at the moment, looking very closely at what's happening with PCBs on the Hudson. You know, our commissioner has said that the job isn't done. We really need to be doing more. I would say that is our number one fight on the Hudson at the moment.
Will that matter? I'm sorry to ask you guys this question, but would that matter whether there's a Democrat or governor or a Republican governor, if they're going to appoint a commissioner of DEC? You've lived through both, right? I mean, you lived through Pataki, you've lived through the Cuomos and all the rest of it. Is there a big difference when a political party changes?
There is a big difference when a different politician comes into office. And I wouldn't say that it has to do with political party necessarily. I've seen Republicans and Democrats take a stand to clean up the Hudson. There have definitely been times in our history when certain administrations have tried to slow it down or stall it, often in Washington.
Now, George Pataki saw himself as an environmentalist, I know that, and he bought a lot of land for the state, you know, upstate, and added to the holdings of the state. But some of these guys are environmentalists in some areas, but not in all areas. In other words, you know, clean up the Hudson may be a little bit more contentious for some than buying land, more land in the Adirondacks. There's a question there somewhere.
Well, George Pataki did take a stand that the Hudson had to be cleaned up.
And was the mayor of a Hudson River town.
At the time, he was the governor.
No, but before that, he had been the mayor of a Hudson River town.
Yeah, I think everyone would agree that Governor Pataki had a passion for the Hudson River and was, you know, instrumental in seeing it protected. As, you know, I would say the same for our current governor.
Where does that manifest itself?
Well, like I said, among other things, in his very strong support for our program.
And right.
Building that up.
What about the legislature? Does the legislature get involved in the Hudson at all?
Not as much as they used to. You know, there was a time when you had members of the legislature, Maurice Hinchey, George Pataki, when he was in the legislature, very actively supporting the Hudson. I think that is starting to change. You're starting to see more engagement with the Hudson in the state legislature and in Congress. But it has, you know, not been the same as it was, say, 30 years ago.
Right. Tom?
I have fights too, Alan, a much lower level than...
You look like a fighter.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As we're talking, I'm thinking about what are the things that I run into each day when I'm out in the field. And one of the ones I just ran into the other day, right now the bald eagles in this area, the local eagles, so we've got more than 36 nests in the Hudson Valley right now, way more than that, actually. Most of those eagles are readying their nests right now for the coming breeding season. They'll be on eggs by a month from now, and by the 1st of April, we'll have little baby fledglings in the nest.
Or and the mama sits with them, and the papa goes.
They share it. They share it, depending on the male. Some of the males feel it's all the woman's duty, and some of the males share it. It's usually 18 hours for the female sitting on the eggs and about 6 for the males. What I'm running into, and I run into this 2 or 3 times every year, is photographers who want to get that perfect shot, and I'll see them throwing rocks at nests to get the eagles to fly. And, of course, we have a lot of federal protection for bald eagles, the Bald Eagle Protection Act, among others. And many of these people you can't reason with. There was one woman the other day, I say a woman only because she was a woman, but it could have been a man. And she had her hands on the tree, and she was yelling to her lungs, and she made the eagles fly. And I asked her, what are you doing? She
you told just me, came upon her?
Yeah, I see. I monitor some bald eagle nests to make sure that these kind of things don't happen. Because if this goes too far, the eagles will abandon the nest, and if there's babies in there, the babies will die. And so she told me that it was her constitutional right to do whatever she felt like. And she ended the conversation by saying, they're just birds. And that's someone who's not connected to the world that they live in. The other day, there were 5,000 Canada geese out in the field. And there was a photographer. I don't know why it's always photographers, but they want the perfect picture. And this guy drives up, and he gets out, and he honked his horn and honked his horn and honked his horn until those geese took off, and he got the perfect shot. What I try to explain to these people, I usually don't get very far, is that in winter, birds are looking to conserve energy. Conservation energy is a big thing in the winter. Birds are mostly looking, from eagles to geese, they're looking to consume the amount of calories during the day they'll need to get to keep their furnace stoked all night long when they're sitting in a tree. When we make them fly, when we throw rocks at them, when we honk our horns, when we bother them, now that creates a deficit. Now before they can go night roost someplace, now they've got to go and replenish the pantry. And, you know, a lot of these people, when I talk to them, they just don't understand.
That's interesting. Should there be more done? In other words, should there be more protection?
Well, this is clearly against the law. And on occasion when I've called a DEC enforcement officer, by the time they get there, the people have left. And so it's rare that these infractions ever go to where something happens.
Oh, that really takes us back to the almanac and the reason for why we have the almanac, which is to help people get in touch with nature, you know, especially with all electronics available to us these days. It's harder and harder to get people to step outside their door to connect with nature, but when they do, that's when people have this feeling about the importance of how they fit into the natural world. They see the forces of nature at work. They understand much more about the ecosystem than if they're in their home looking, you know, just at a program on television or on Facebook, for example. So the almanac is a way to provide, in a way, emotional support to the people who are doing this, validation for them that they're getting out of nature, they're seeing something, and that people care about what they're seeing, and they're sharing it with their friends and their neighbors, and more people are going out. The subscriptions to the almanac have just been skyrocketing. We've been amazed to see, you know, how the numbers of people that are subscribing to it are just going up and up and up.
And what do you think that is?
I think it's because people really want to have that understanding of nature. They are fascinated to learn what's going on outside their door. You know, Tom might have a more direct pulse on what people are responding to.
Well, most partly it's because anyone can be involved. It's not elitist. And everyone has a way in which they can donate to the almanac their ideas. If you're a poet, you can write a poem. If you're a writer, you can write prose. If you're a photographer, you can send me a photo. If you're a scientist, you can send me data. The almanac tries to meld all of those various ways of communicating together so that it's not boring, so that it's an exciting story. It's the beauty of a sunrise, the beauty of a sunset. Oh, and by the way, there were 74 eagles on the Hudson River this afternoon. That means X, Y, and Z. And here's a poem to tell you all about it. When you blend those kinds of perspectives together, you get context and you get a feeling for what the river is all about.
Well, it's been terrific talking with both of you. We've been talking with Tom Lake, a DEC consultant and estuary naturalist with the Hudson River Estuary Program. I've learned a lot today, I really have. And Francis Dunwell, Fran Dunwell, special assistant and Hudson River Estuary Coordinator. And they've been talking to us about the Hudson River Almanac. Tom, perhaps you could give us where you go to sign up for that.
Well, there's a couple of ways. Fran mentioned earlier you can Google Hudson River Almanac, and that will lead you through, I believe, a DEC website. My email address, people often send me the requests right through my email. My email address is trlake7@aol.com. I have an AOL address only because it's easy for people to remember.
And I take it you'd love to have even more people reading the almanac.
Well, the value of the almanac is it is this compilation of ideas and thoughts and perspectives from such a broad range of people and of all ages and of all talents. I mean, I have poetry coming from elementary school children, which is just wonderful stuff. Yeah.
Well, Fran and Tom, loved having you here. We've all learned a great deal about the Hudson River and about estuaries, and I've always known about that stuff of the salt coming up and then the fresh water going down. And every once in a while, I find it helpful to show my prowess with that single fact by telling somebody what the Hudson River really is. So is it really the Hudson River estuary as opposed to the Hudson River?
Well, the Hudson River is an estuary for 150 miles up to Troy, and then it's a river without being an estuary north of that.
Well, again, thank you both for coming to be here with us.
Thank
you, Alan. Our pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.